This podcast is part of the Acast Creator Network.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to The Stand with Eamon Dunphy. Now, anybody watching the World Cup, despite the controversies in the background and the horrendous nature of the country it's being played in, can't help but be moved by what they see and can't help but understand how important it is for people, how much love and passion is poured into supporting their teams. You can see it. Japanese, Moroccans, Australians, the Senegalese, and of course the big nations as well, Brazilians, Argentinians. It really is a wonderful event. The emotions invested in it are extraordinary, and we've seen some wonderful pictures in the last few days. Now we move on to the knockout stages of the tournament, and yet there is a shadow over the tournament. It's the shadow of FIFA's corruption and Qatari bigotry, really, or worse. We're joined now from Doha by Miguel Delaney. Miguel is chief football writer with The Independent in London, and he's out there covering for his paper. Miguel, I would ask you to just confirm the passion that you must feel in the stadium at certain moments. We saw it with Japan last night. We saw it with Morocco. People are so invested in this, moved to tears, genuinely moved to tears, either winning or losing.
Oh yeah, and that is essentially precisely what Qatar have bought with this World Cup. That's the big calculation made. It's essentially the impurity of what they're doing is basically exploiting the purity of football, you'd say. Yeah, because I was in the stadium last night for the Japan Spain game. I was in the stadium the previous night for Argentina, Poland. And I mean, the cut-through of the World Cup, it really is remarkable. There's genuinely nothing like it, certainly in global sport, almost in global news. And it's even, I mean, one of the things that really strikes, even here, in which is pretty much the strangest place I've ever been for an international tournament. This is my ninth now. But it's the feel of being at basically a major global news event. And as you can see, once it gets into it, and again, this is exactly what the Qatar state was banking on. Once the football starts, it's impossible for that emotional investment not to take over the drama. And I think we said it before, but say with a moment like Richarlison's goal against Serbia, or Messi's against Mexico, or even what happened last night with Japan and Spain. Well, Qatar is now going to be forever associated with these positive moments in the way you'd say you hear the words Azteca and you think of Pele in 1970 or Maradona in 1986. That's what they're doing. And it does mean this World Cup is full of contradictions and kind of conflicting emotions in that sense, because, and the one thing I would say as well, because I suppose it's part of the bigger discussion. I mean, it sometimes feels as if FIFA are determined to ruin their golden goose. Even people within some of the federations that are qualified feel that. They think, they would maintain that the decision to persist with Qatar is damaging to the sport, not least because of all the questions it brings. Then you've got what's potentially happening next. I mean, this tournament's actually been, with the amount of drama in this group stage, I actually can't remember an opening round like it. Especially, I mean, last night.
No, and it's high quality stuff as well. I mean, one of the facts, footballing facts of the tournament is the emergence and strengthening of what were minnows in the game. Japan, Morocco, Senegal, the African champions, also. These nations now have produced technically and tactically very, very good, good players and very good groups.
Yeah, that's exactly it. But and even that showcase, I mean, shows there's a threshold for these teams to meet. And I think you would say that the 32-team tournament is almost kind of perfectly symmetrical. You could argue it's a bit too big, but it does mean you've got that kind of that classic split between group stage, which means everyone qualifies, has good time in the tournament, it gets a proper event, and we get a really good group stage. And it's cleanly split into the last 16. But of course, what's going to happen next? Well,
Sorry to interrupt you, Miguel.
Yeah.
I don't want to let the moment pass. I have heard and read that there are 48 nations who will qualify for the next World Cup in the United States in 2026. Was I hearing things, or is that true?
Well, it'll either be 40 or 48. My instinct would almost be that it's going to be 40 because it's not that big a jump yet. And also, crucially, if you only go to 40, it means in future you've got the potential political leverage of 48. That's a vote winner in the future.
Right. Okay. Yeah, let me ask you something else about the vibe around the tournament. You've been to a lot of them, and you start a piece you wrote for your newspaper in a taxi with a South Asian taxi driver asking for a tip. Could you give me a tip, please? I have no money to eat. And knowing journalists the way I do at major tournaments, there are probably five of you in the taxi.
Yeah.
You're all getting dockets, as if there was one of you in the taxi. So you were all on an earner straight away. So I hope you gave him a good tip. I wonder why you had to ask for it. But go on, tell me about that.
It's on Uber now, so you have to actually click the button. It's not...
All right.
You shouldn't be laughing about something so poignant. But it was a few of us in it, obviously. But I mean, this is the thing about it. But it's moments like that as well. This harsh reality that also instantly takes you out of the illusion of the World Cup. And this, I would say, happens a few times a day. And it's something that I think that's always worth stressing about what this is. I mean, one thing I've noticed in the past few days is there's just a growing sense of kind of people would say large social media followings, whatever, we're talking about, well, Qatar, obviously a lot of issues, but, you know, I'm having a great time here. Everything, we're looked after. Everyone's very nice. Everything runs smoothly. But that's the entire point. I mean, that's why. Of course, well, relatively wealthy Westerners are going to have a good time, and that again, that was another calculation made. But equally, I mean, that good time is dependent, and this is why I'd go so far as likening it to it. It must be like, say, the Deep South in America in plantation times, because you're surrounded by this underclass of people who make everything work, and I think. They almost kind of, even though they're essential to the running of Qatar, and let's not forget the UAE, Saudi Arabia, because this system of migrant yes. labor is prevalent through the area, but they almost become invisible. And it's something that human rights groups would constantly stress as well, but they are everywhere. I do wonder whether the longer you spend in states like this, it just becomes a kind of an accepted reality. When in truth, it's an obnoxious immorality.
Yeah, you do also point to a couple of things that are fascinating. You were talking to an environmentalist, Mike Berners-Lee, who said, and I quote, "The World Cup is going to be the highest carbon event, apart from war, that humans have ever staged." And you go on in your piece to give examples. For example, there are no team sheets. And there are no programs at these games. Now, fans will know, keeping your program in particular to remember occasions important in your sporting life is part of, you know, the tradition. The idea that this is a high carbon event in what is supposed to be a green World Cup is bizarre, perverse.
Oh, But it also points to the fact, I mean, let's also not forget what we're dealing with here. It's a police state, an autocracy. The emir has virtually absolute power. You can't really trust anything that's said. It's a state that operates without a free press. Dissent is suppressed. And from that perspective as well, they're not used to being challenged, which is why they're not used to the official version of events being challenged, which is why we've had so many flashpoints about issues like the number of migrant workers that have died. Or the kind of even elements around the wearing of rainbow items to the stadiums.
I thought the players gave in, Miguel, very easily. I know that the sanctions were put on them very late so that they couldn't talk to their peers in other camps and therefore, you know, didn't know what to do. But there are strong soccer European nations, Germany, England, of course, Wales, even France, all of these nations were not prepared, or were they, to stand up and say to FIFA and to the host nation, no, if you insist on that, you won't have a tournament.
Well, just the first thing I would say, I thought the German response to that was impressive.
Yes, it was.
It's clearly rattled the Qatari state, given just now the Germans have gone out this morning and there's been footage from Qatari TV of all these pundits in one of the television programs doing kind of that silence gesture that the Germans did.
Yes.
And waving goodbye, which is essentially belittling a gesture of solidarity with a criminalized community here, which is remarkable. And again, remarkable we're in the situation. In terms of the armband itself, I think if you actually take the case on its individual merits, where the Germans are describing extreme blackmail. I've been told that had they worn the armbands, it was unlimited liability, so we could have had players suspended for games. Whatever. If you take that on its individual merits, you can understand the decision. But all that does is, it basically, as you say, these players have huge leverage, huge voices. All it does is expose the fact that they didn't do enough in the build-up. I mean, they could have used their voice much more strongly. So to pin it all on an armband that was quite a weak gesture in the first place, but obviously accumulated this greater importance as things went on, that's poor. Because I suppose this kind of cuts back to a bigger debate about this whole tournament where in the 70s, say, ahead of 1978, obviously the calls for boycotts ahead of Argentina. That doesn't happen now because I think human rights groups had taken a more kind of nuanced approach to it and feel these things can be challenged in a different way. So I think the players are given a bit of a pass for going. But at the same time, they are benefiting. Their careers are benefiting from this immoral World Cup. So I don't think they can plead ignorance. I think they have a responsibility at the very least to use their voice there. And if they don't say anything, I think it does ultimately reflect badly on them because, they can't say they weren't told.
Well, we can point to Ronaldo Cristiano, who is receiving 178 million a year to go and play in Saudi next season. We can also point to the fact that Lionel Messi is an ambassador for the Saudis. I think his fee is 25 million a year, although I may have missed a zero at the end of that. But when players of that stature, who are already extremely well off, allow themselves to flog themselves to the Saudis, it's deeply unimpressive.
Well, it also points to the lack of scrutiny or any questioning the game in that sense, which is reflective of how basically we've had these states able to buy clubs, completely able to disrupt the top of the sport. And in that context, most of the players just aren't asking questions. I mean, you'd wonder what the discussions with their advisor were, whereas no one saying, do you think this is a bad idea? I mean, how much money does Messi need?
The point is, though, Miguel, this is our problem with discussing sport and politics, is that there's Grand Prix held in Saudi, there's golf tournaments now held in Saudi, everything, football, they were in the World Cup, they've just gone home because they lost the game. So once you start looking too closely at the relationship between sportsmen and women and these repulsive regimes, you go down a rabbit hole that you might never get out of. Let me ask you something else, and it's a point you made in your piece, and it's always a point very well made. There is among the local people in Qatar, the ordinary people, great pride. Qatar is the first Muslim nation, first Arab nation, to host a major tournament like the World Cup. And that is a source of pride to the local people.
Yeah, and not just the local people, I would say, but also essentially the entire Middle East and Muslim world. Because even we got İlkay Gündoğan in the mix zone the other day after Germany's draw with Spain.
Yes.
And he made a point of almost saying, I understand, I gather actually there's been maybe a little bit more tension within the German camp about the politics than maybe was initially portrayed. But Gundogan did make a point of saying, I'm from a Muslim community, Muslim family, and there's great pride about that the Muslim world has finally got to stage a tournament. And that is a very noble thing. Now, it does, I suppose, provoke some bigger debates in terms of kind of, because criminalization of homosexuality is an issue in a lot of predominantly Muslim countries, although many human rights groups would stress that that is not compatible with Islam. That was a point specifically made to us by Human Rights Watch on the eve of the tournaments. So it does provoke bigger debates, and kind of it's the two sides of this as well, because you could fairly say this part of the world, it's overdue, really. And Morocco have been trying for a tournament for so long. That could have been held without many of the issues within Qatar. But then, of course, Qatar had $220 billion to spend on an entire infrastructure.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Let me ask you about David Beckham, Miguel, and the rumor or fact that he signed a $200 million 10-year deal to be a cultural ambassador for Qatar. Can that possibly be true?
Well, I mean, it hasn't been denied. A lot of people have been reporting it quite freely. Now,
he's some beaut, isn't he, David?
Sir David.
Is he getting any stick? I don't see the English journalists writing about this the way I feel they should be. I mean, it's not for me to tell them what to write, but this guy was the ambassador for England when Qatar robbed the World Cup off them in 2010.
Yeah, from that perspective, it's remarkable. Now, to be fair, I think just before the tournament, there were a lot of pieces about Beckham. Sam Wallace did one in the Daily Telegraph, and there's been some stuff in The Guardian. But it's interesting that perspective as well, because Beckham is everywhere at this tournament. You see him in every corner, but he's also nowhere. Because I think this is exactly this point of what you're talking about. It's quite funny for someone that's such a high-profile ambassador in discard, usually in those cases, to do all sorts of media interviews talking about how great it all is. There hasn't been one here. There's been no press conference, Beckham. There's been no interviews with English press that we were expecting. Before he came, he's got this new documentary out on Disney Plus or something, where they had some public event in London just before the World Cup that I got an invite to, but couldn't go to, and there was no, as far as I gather, there was no press interview there, no press conference. And that's obviously because, I suppose, one of the first questions would be some pretty uncomfortable questions.
What is he known for these days, Miguel?
Being David Beckham.
And what does David Beckham actually do?
Well, I suppose, this is another kind of calculation.
Is he a kind of football version of the Kardashians?
That's pretty much it. I mean, because by having Beckham, what do you have? He kind of bestows a glamour on Qatar. That feels like it's pretty much it. Because even it doesn't feel, and let's not forget, Beckham, all right, at his peak, he probably became quite overrated, especially around that 2006 period. I remember you discussing this on TV a lot. But before that, we were like, he used to be known as a really honest, hardworking pro.
Yeah.
Had that brilliant foot. But it does feel like that's kind of passing. He's not really known for that anymore. Every so often you get this debate about how good a player Beckham actually was. But he's not really put in that context. It's kind of like his status or fame has transcended football. And he's just basically, he's almost a professional David Beckham now.
Yeah, he's just a figure who is vacuous and he ghosts around the place. And you can read about him in the Mail Online every day. Now, Miguel, just let me ask you a couple of serious questions about what may be done to save football in particular, although all sports are in danger. Budweiser had a deal with FIFA. They're a beer supplier, as we know, and alcohol was banned in the stadium, which I think is a very good idea. They should ban it from most stadiums. Nevertheless, why did FIFA do a deal with Budweiser if they must have known this was likely to happen in a Muslim country? And where are Budweiser allowed to sell their beer, if anywhere now? And will they sponsor the next World Cup?
Well, it's in the fan zones. I mean, I think the relationship with FIFA will persist. I suppose what that story really sums up. And as you say, I think it wouldn't have been a bad thing had they just banned alcohol from stadiums for this tournament. And had that been done months out, I think people would have understood it. I mean, it should be appreciated. It's in a Muslim country in that regard. It was the fact it was in 2 days, and as you know, as so many people on the ground here involved in federations have told me, it does kind of show who's really running this tournament, which is Qatar, and the FIFA have almost been kind of left.
Yes,
you know, in Qatar's wake in that regard. So I mean, I would say Budweiser will persist. You do see it everywhere. I mean, it's all over the fan zone. There's a media bar in the big main media center where you can buy cans of Budweiser for the equivalent of €10, and they're the cheapest in the city.
Is that before or after you file your copy? Anyway,
I've been clean this tournament. We're working too hard.
Let me ask you another question, Miguel, before I let you go, because this is very important. It seems to me that either football gets rid of FIFA and its corrupt and corrupting setup, everything about it, or FIFA will destroy football. And there's some evidence when you look at the footballing side of things that they won't mind. What would happen if 10 major European countries said to FIFA, goodbye, it's over, you don't run us anymore?
I don't think that's imminent, but...
No, it's not, but we can't go on with this corrupt and corrupting governing body destroying the game and making it disreputable.
But it's exactly... I mean, certainly, I suppose, the tectonic plates of football are really shifting. And if you talk to so many people in the game now, they'll basically say, we're on the brink of maybe the biggest shift in football since, probably bigger than Bosman, really, because what's happening with FIFA ties in with something bigger that they're connected to. Obviously, there's all sorts going on in the club game where there's been concerns about, you know, the rise of these state clubs, how leagues like Germany or Italy or France are running away with things. So that has led to, I mean, already you've got a lot of people in football who basically are openly saying now the game needs a reset.
Yeah.
That runs alongside the ongoing attempts to set up a Super League. And there's the next stage of that legal proceeding on the 15th December, which will basically decide whether it will go to a full hearing at the European Court of Justice, and which will basically decide whether bodies like FIFA and UEFA have a monopoly to or they have a kind of a business monopoly in terms of running football, whereas they would argue they're safeguarding the sport, which of course opens up the bigger questions. I mean, FIFA is supposed to be the ultimate authority in the game. It's supposed to safeguard what it's about, but it basically can't do anything about competitive balance, about distribution of resources, and most obviously at the moment, the takeover of the game, really, by these deeply problematic states who essentially are starting to run the world economy through fossil fuels.
Yes.
And in fact, you could even argue that FIFA facilitate this. And then as you pointed there, you've got this ongoing split where UEFA and CONMEBOL, the South American Federation, have had a stronger alliance in the last 2 years. That was in response to FIFA attempting a biennial World Cup. And there's always that almost implicit threat. Well, you might have the competition and what you want to do with it, but we've got all the big countries, we've got the stars. If we went our own way, that'd be FIFA done.
Yeah.
But then, of course, FIFA themselves, there's a theory within the club game that the biennial World Cup was all a bit of a Trojan horse or a bait and switch or whatever you want to call it, that FIFA were trying to leverage a situation where they'd say, okay, we won't have a biennial World Cup, but we want to have an expanded club World Cup, because a lot of people in the club game believe that what Infantino really wants is the Champions League money, because given the World Cup is only every 4 years and as beautiful as it is and all the rest of it, the real money is in the club game, and who controls the clubs controls the sport. So we have all these competing forces, and I think 2023, I suppose, really starting with what might happen in mid-December, 2 weeks' time, it could be a very, very interesting year for the game.
Yeah, just let me give an opinion, Miguel. In the Bosman case, which changed football forever and dramatically, in terms of what players could earn and what they could do and how free they were, the argument put up by the football people that would have kept Bosman after his contract period had ended, would have allowed his club to keep him, they were arguing that football was a sport. It was not a business. And therefore, they were entitled to have their own rules. The European Court found that football was not a sport. Primarily, it was a business. Therefore, Bosman had to be treated like any other business employee whose contract had run out. In other words, he was free. The same principle will govern the attempt to form a Super League, and the court will rule in favour of the clubs, the 12 clubs who are trying to start it. That's my view. I don't know if you guys in the press pack now have talked about these matters, but there is a direct parallel argument.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've been speaking to people involved, and as well, to be fair, it should be stressed, it's not the 12 anymore. It's basically these three clubs.
Three, yes, but they're acting,
Barcelona and Juventus.
Yeah, because they're broke, Miguel, and their countries are dropping out and they can't even qualify for the knockout stages tournaments.
The other side of that is, clubs like Madrid and Barcelona, I mean, they shouldn't be afforded really much sympathy because they've run the game as they've seen fit. They're used to being the top dogs and kind of dictating things and creating situations where the game has this issue of financial distribution. But it equally can't be ignored that the reason they've moved for this is because of football's failure to regulate state-owned clubs. It's kind of, I mean, so what's actually happening is that far from more competitive variety in the sport and kind of, you say, more clubs being able to win things, which should be what it's really about, the top field just gets narrower and narrower. Well, from that perspective, so from speaking to people involved, they really think it's 50-50. The one thing this time, UEFA have a lot of, from a lot of lobbying, they've got a lot of political support, and there is this feeling that there's an element of our necessity for cultural protection here, especially given I've subsequently been told as well that UEFA are increasingly conscious of the issue of nation states, most of those from the Middle East because of the Gulf blockade, seeking to distort sport or buy clubs, and there's a consideration there. They're looking at what next. That could see UEFA win. But, I mean, as was put to me, this will probably end in some sort of legal fudge. And what we might see is not UEFA broken up, but essentially kind of walls put between its various parts. I mean, because this is one point where the Super League, there's actually logic to what they say. I mean, because you could fairly criticize FIFA and particularly UEFA in this regard for facilitating or fostering a situation where most of Europe, in terms of the economics of football, is a wasteland. Like if you go east of Munich, these great football heartlands, you would have played in so many of these countries. None of their clubs are powerful anymore. A lot of their national teams are, because there isn't the infrastructure. So much of the wealth is in Western Europe, basically in almost seven geographical pockets. And UEFA has a responsibility there. That's where an argument could be made that they're actually not overseeing the culture of the game in that regard. But equally alongside that, there's almost this contradiction. And this is something else that the Super League lawyers are honing in on, where FIFA and UEFA are supposed to be authorities, or they're supposed to kind of be overseers of the game, kind of safeguards. But yet, at the same time, they're actually in business competition with the club. They're in this marketplace because, the Champions League and the World Cup, these aren't just sporting competitions. They're products competing for commercial revenue.
Okay, it's a conversation for another day, but we're very grateful to you for joining us on this. And I should say to our listeners, Miguel has a newsletter which you get sent to your inbox for free. It's called Reading the Game, and you can sign up for that if you wish. We're very grateful to Miguel Delaney, and we hope he survives this World Cup. Who's going to win, Miguel, in one word?
Brazil.
Well done. Right answer. I backed him. That's Miguel Delaney, chief football writer with The Independent in London, who's in Qatar reporting for his paper. We're grateful to Miguel, to all of you for listening. That's all we have time for now. We'll talk to you soon.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.